Welcome to the CLL edition of Rare Disease Advisor's Rare Care Podcast, offering unique perspectives from researchers, clinicians, and influencers from the chronic lymphocytic leukemia community.
Hello, and welcome to the Rare Care Podcast. This is your host, Larry Luxner, Senior Correspondent for Rare Disease Advisor. We're here at SoHo 2025 in Houston, Texas, and our guest today is Dr. Jennifer Brown of the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. Dr. Brown directs the CLL Center of Dana-Farber's Division of Hematologic Malignancies. As such, it's one of the few centers in the United States dedicated to treating and researching this disease. And at this conference, less than 2 hours ago, in fact, Dr. Brown received the Michael J. Keating Outstanding Achievement Award. Congratulations on that award. Dr. Brown, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
My pleasure. And thank you.
Sure. So let's start by talking about this disease, chronic lymphocytic leukemia. Tell us a bit about it and how prevalent it is.
It's essentially a chronic blood cancer. People are diagnosed with it often as an incidental finding when they don't have any symptoms and can live with it for a long time, potentially without treatment. About a quarter of people diagnosed may never need treatment. And then the others may come to treatment at some point that could be anywhere from a couple years after diagnosis to decades after diagnosis. And in the last 15 years, we've made marked strides in getting away from chemotherapy to targeted therapies that are highly effective and very well tolerated.
And basically, it affects people usually past 60, correct?
That's right. The median age of diagnosis is about 72. About a third of people are under 60 at diagnosis.
So are there any geographic or ethnic considerations for the disease, or it affects people equally?
So it tends to affect Northern European ethnicity in particular, and it's also enriched in patients of Ashkenazi Jewish descent. And then Africans are next. Native Americans have a lower rate, and so in the North and South American areas, a lot has to do with the degree of European admixture in terms of the incidence. And East Asia is very rare. It's very rare in Japan, and we don't really understand why. This is a topic of some interest, though.
This is incredible. Yesterday, we spoke with an expert on myelofibrosis, also tends to affect Ashkenazi Jews. Is there any particular reason for this?
Well, I think perhaps there's a relatively small population, and more inbreeding within a relatively small population has led to some of these mutations persisting that relate to cancer, for example, like the BRCA genes, for example.
Of course. And you said, and also Africans tend to be affected?
Less than Europeans, but yes, it is still common amongst Africans.
And then at the other end of the spectrum are Asians, which are almost never affected.
Right. So India and China have some incidence, but lower than these other groups. But Japan, very, very rare.
Very interesting. So how widespread is CLL in the United States?
There are a couple hundred thousand people living with it. And every year, there are about 23,000 people newly diagnosed. But then, because it's a chronic disease, people live a very long time. And so the prevalence is increasing.
Right. And your center, of course, is, like we said, one of the few centers that actually is dedicated to treating and researching the disease, right?
That's right.
Why is that?
A lot of times, I think it's folded in with other types of lymphoma. Even though it's called a leukemia, biologically, it's more related to other lymphomas. And so many institutions just aren't big enough to have people who subspecialize in it. But I took an early interest in this disease. I'm interested in actually doing science to understand the mechanisms of disease and why different drugs may or may not work. And that's something you can do really easy because the cells are in the blood and people are always happy to give you more blood to study. And so it facilitated research. I'm also interested in the inheritance of these diseases, and CLL is actually the most inherited of various lymphomas. So all these things led me to take an interest in it. And in order to sort of subspecialize and start to offer specialty care to patients, I founded this center, and we started offering extra prognostic testing. My goal has always been to have a clinical trial for every phase of the disease, because until we're curing everyone, which right now we can't really cure almost anyone, we should be learning, and we should be offering new things.
Thank you for bringing that up, because I wanted to ask you about your background as a physician and as a researcher. How did you get started?
Oh, how did I get started? Even as a child, I was kind of fascinated by diseases and disease mechanisms. And then I got very interested in genetics in high school. And so I sort of came in from the science side a little bit, working in genetics and in molecular biology, but had always had this fascination with disease. And so those kind of merged for me doing an MD-PhD. And then when I hit medical school, hematology caught my fancy. Yeah, I love looking at the cells under the microscope. And then clinically, I like lymphomas, and then that led to CLL as a... It's just a very widely divergent disease. It has very different behavior in different people, which makes it interesting. And then, as I said, it's good for research and good for trying to understand the inheritance of lymphomas.
And you did say in your talk briefly just a couple of hours ago that it's a very varied disease, that it doesn't always present the same in two people.
Exactly.
Why is that?
Well, we don't really know exactly, to be honest. I think some of it is a lack of adequate understanding. Mm-hmm. It probably should be at least two diseases, in my opinion, based on its clinical behavior. But because of the way we classify disease, it still remains one because certain features are similar across these different factors. But the way the disease behaves based on some of these genetic factors is so different that it almost warrants calling it a different disease. If we did that, the variability would be less.
Understood. Let's talk, if we could, about these inhibitors, if we could. BTK inhibitor resistance, for example, that was the topic of your talk. Can you explain what that is exactly and how it works?
Sure. So when we started developing targeted inhibitors for CLL, the CLL comes from a B cell. And so B cells are lymphocytes that fight infection. And they're very dependent on what we call the B cell receptor. That's how they interact with the environment. They get stimuli to grow and divide from whatever is able to bind to their B cell receptor. And it turns out that that goes through this protein, BTK, to stimulate the proliferation of the cells. And so that was a very, very good target for developing a drug. And so we now have a number of drugs against BTK that inhibit it, and that really shuts down the CLL cells. They become very quiescent, and many of them die. But what happens is that if you use the drug as a single agent over time, the patients with more aggressive disease start to get resistance mutations. And that's what I was talking about in my talk.
You were one of the first clinicians to look into this, right?
Yeah.
Right. And when was this?
Oh, around 2011, 2013. So the first approval for any BTK inhibitor was fall of 2013, and it was approved for CLL in 2014. We didn't start to learn about resistance until a little bit later.
Amazing. And before that, there were no such inhibitors.
That's right. We used chemotherapy. And we had, by combining various different drugs, we actually had some highly effective chemotherapy. But the best agents were kind of toxic. So we could only give them to the younger patients. And as we said, this is a disease of older people. And so many of them were not able to get those drugs.
Because chemotherapy has some very serious side effects.
Right, exactly.
So you have to be careful who you offer this to.
Right.
Right. Speaking about the inhibitors, it was a matter of time before you learned that patients would develop a resistance to them.
Right. But I should say it's pretty typical that cancer becomes resistant to whatever you're treating it with. It was a familiar idea. It happens with chemotherapy, too. But a lot of times the resistance that develops with chemotherapy is much less specific. It's much less well understood. Whereas with the targeted inhibitors, it's often the target that changes. Mutates, we call it.
Can you talk about, just walk us through that, some of the drugs that you came up with?
Well, sure. Not just me, it was pharmaceutical companies and a whole variety of other clinical investigators right. have been involved in developing them. But we first improved on the irreversible inhibitors. So we have several newer ones called acalabrutinib and zanubrutinib, which are better tolerated and, at least in the case of zanubrutinib, more effective than the first generation inhibitor. And then more recently, we have a drug called pirtobrutinib. Now, this is not an irreversible inhibitor, but it works in patients whose disease carries the mutation that confers resistance to the covalent one. So that's what's really exciting. But now what we learned, and what I spoke about in my talk, is that there are yet other mutations that occur that block the pirtobrutinib. And some of them are also mutations against the other inhibitors. So it's sort of like a jigsaw puzzle now. Different mutations, different drugs, and how do you put them together to try to treat the patient most effectively based on what they have in their disease.
But overall, your message seems to say that you've made tremendous progress with the disease.
Tremendous
compared to
progress.
20 years ago, let's say.
Oh, absolutely. It's night and day, completely new world.
Well, and you have seen personally your patients improve.
Oh, yeah. I treated some very sick patients who'd had multiple rounds of chemotherapy, had huge disease, lymph nodes out to here with some of these early drugs, and the lymph nodes just melted away.
They melted away?
Yeah, in a day or two.
Wow, and you didn't expect that?
And no, because it wasn't something that we saw with any of the other things that we had to offer the patients. Sometimes with first-line treatment with chemo, you could get the lymph nodes melting away. But these people had been through multiple rounds, and their disease was refractory, and it wasn't really responding to anything. And now it was melting away.
Amazing. In your talk, you said that it's easier for cancer cells to become resistant to one drug than to multiple drugs. In fact, 2 and 3 drug combinations may actually improve outcomes.
Right.
Can you elaborate on that?
Right. Well, so it's sort of mathematical, right? If you figure the cell needs a mutation to become resistant, and if you have one drug, you may only need one mutation. But if you have 2 drugs that work by different mechanisms, then you're going to need 2 totally different mutations to become resistant to them both at once. And that's harder for one cell to get 2 totally different mutations than to get 1 mutation. And so that's sort of been the rationale for combinations of therapy and cancer for a long time, for combinations of chemo, but it applies to the targeted inhibitors as well. And so now there's a lot of interest in combining the BTK inhibitors with our other main class of targeted inhibitor, which is the BCL2 inhibitors. Venetoclax is the most notable one of those. Because they work by different mechanisms, have different resistance mechanisms, you put them together, we can suppress the disease further, hopefully avoid resistance, and then even stop the drugs when the patients are in a deep remission. So that takes off the pressure that's driving the cancer to become resistant. And hopefully then we'll have less resistance.
Amazing. If we could just talk a bit about life expectancy in CLL. Mm-hmm. What is the average?
You know, we don't even know. So back in the 90s, before we had any of the targeted inhibitors, before we even had the best chemo, you know, I mentioned there's that one key prognostic marker. So people with the worst version had about a 10-year life expectancy back then. And people with the good version still had a more than 25-year life expectancy. You know, now I think my goal for all of those patients is to get them to their natural life expectancy, whatever that is. You know, the younger the patient, the longer that is. But certainly people even with that, who previously had that 10-year life expectancy, we have out, you know, 25 years, and hopefully more. But it hasn't really been that well studied or quantified with people who've only had the new therapies.
Right. I wanted to ask you about patient advocacy. Mm-hmm. You did mention the CLL Society. What has been your experience working with the patient advocacy organizations?
Well, they provide really great services for the patients. You know, they curate a lot of the information that's out there and provide a good online source of accurate patient-friendly information. And so that's incredibly helpful because, you know, especially with this disease, patients get diagnosed, they often don't do anything. So it's very disturbing, right? You're told you have a leukemia or a cancer, but you can't do anything about it. So you're going to go online and try and find what's out there. But then what they find is often out of date or unhelpful. And so the patient advocacy organizations, you know, they run support groups, they get people connected to each other, and they provide accurate patient-friendly information that we can refer people to. So that's really helpful.
Wonderful. I'd like to wrap up. We only have a minute or two left about this award. Is it something you were expecting?
No, not really. I'm very honored to receive it. I had worked with Michael earlier in my career, and I always admired his approach to CLL research and his incisive questions in meetings. And so it's quite an honor.
Congratulations. So we've been talking with Dr. Jennifer Brown of the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. This is Larry Luxner for Rare Disease Advisor.
Be sure to follow the latest news, perspectives, and clinical resources on rare diseases at rarediseaseadvisor.com. Thank you for listening.